Okay, good morning, everyone. This is Gerardo Brusi. I'm going to put my video on so you know who I am. There you are. I am the chairman of the new Ventura County chapter of the Aerospace and Defense Forum and managing director of BrainSpark Consulting, a product and project management consultancy that helps companies maximize their competitive advantage. Now, last year, as you probably know, has been one of extraordinary challenges for the aviation industry, and the next few months will be critical, and so it is important for all of us to get clarity on what the future may hold, and we have just the right person to explain what the outlook for the industry might be. So it is with a great privilege to welcome Richard Abulafia, Vice President of the TEAL Group, who will be presenting this morning's topic on the defense and aviation markets, navigating the COVID aftermath. Okay, I think, Ivan, you want to move to the next slide? Thank you very much. Just a bit on the Aerospace and Defense Forum. The purpose of the forum is to provide a way for those in the industry to support the industry and communicate information and ideas, collaborate on projects, and develop businesses with each other. There are now 9 chapters, including this one, that in the absence of a global pandemic usually meet in person. In addition, there are a monthly newsletter, and for those who subscribe to the forum, over 250 recordings of charter presentations like this one. There's also tours of other aerospace and defense facilities and much more. To continue fulfilling on purpose, we are conducting about 3 webinars a month until in-person meetings can resume. More information can be found in our website, aerospaceanddefenseforum.org. Okay, before we proceed, some logistics. You should be on mute for the entirety of the webinar. We will take questions through the chat box, which you should be able to find kind of in the middle of your screen. Also, please switch off your camera, which are the 2 buttons to the left of your screen. Recordings of the webinar will be posted on the forum. You will be able to download them if you're a member. And all attendees will receive an email when the recording is available. Likewise, attendees will receive a list of all the contact information of the attendees for those who grant permission. Okay. Now, introduction to the presenter. Richard Abulafia, as I said before, Vice President of Analysis of the TEAL Group Corporation, which has been providing intelligence products to the defense and aerospace industries for over 30 years. Richard manages consulting projects in the commercial and military aircraft field and analyzes broader defense and aerospace trends. He has advised numerous aerospace companies, including most prime and second and third-tier contractors in U.S., Europe, and Asia. He also advises numerous financial institutions on aerospace market conditions. Richard writes and edits the TEAL Group's World Military and Civil Aircraft Briefing, a forecasting tool covering over 135 aircraft programs and markets. He also writes publicly about aviation and defense with regular columns on Aviation Week and Space Technology and Forbes.com. He also writes articles that have appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Slate, the AIAA, the Financial Times, Professional Pilots, and many other publications. Frequently cited as an aviation industry authority by trade and news publications, Richard has appeared on numerous broadcast television news radio programs, including ABC, BBC, Bloomberg, Reuters, CBS, CNN, NBC, NPR, and PBS, and probably many other 3-letter acronyms. He has spoken at numerous conferences before as well. Before joining the TEAL Group in 1990, Richard analyzed the jet engine market at James Information Group. He has a master's degree in world studies from King's College, University of London, and a bachelor's degree from George Washington University. And with that, I give you Richard Abulafia. Richard, are you ready?
I am. Thank you very much, Gerardo. It's great to be here this morning. Wish I was still in Los Angeles. Here back east, it's rather rainy and dismal, but hope to cheer you up with a generally upward direction of market numbers here in the aerospace business, having just recovered from the world's worst exogenous shock ever. I think we're all ready for a little bit of at least a small glimpse of California sunshine. So if I could ask Ivan to turn to the first page there, please. Thank you. Next one. This is the rather difficult and way too dense, and I apologize for that, chart of global aviation output by segment. You can see all of the individual segments in the world of aircraft on the left and their relative sizes. And then, of course, the compound annual growth rates over the past few decades, a few selected periods, and what happened last year. And it's not a surprise to anybody, I'm afraid, that last year was, in fact, as our British cousins say, a bit of a dog's breakfast of a year. You know, not a bit of black anywhere, all red. And that was difficult. The only thing I can say is that not all of this was an organic market collapse. Some of it was logistical, related to the pandemic. Like, for example, the fighter market, very important, it fell 23%. None of that was the market. In some cases, the aircraft just simply couldn't be delivered. In some cases, they couldn't be built. Factory closures, travel disruptions, all kinds of logistical complications as a result of the pandemic. However, the big driver behind the aviation business is, of course, moving people. And you can see at the top, single aisle jets and twin aisle jets both fell by about half. That was, of course, an agonizing experience. My number one message for the title of this presentation, though, is that we've fallen into a pit, but it sure feels better climbing out of a pit than falling into one. So 2020, the numbers you see here are the worst numbers we're going to see both in this cycle and hopefully ever. This is just absolutely a traumatic experience for the industry. Next page, please, Ivan. So this is the cause of our problems. You know, when this crisis began, actually it was, I think March 11th was my last plane flight. So what, 16 months ago. And I remember I was in Los Angeles flying back and the plane was half empty and this isn't good. People were starting to wear masks and there was talk of a difficult experience. And Paul Krugman of the Times said, well, the world economy is going into a medically induced coma. That was his phrase. And I thought, okay, that resonates. Now, that sounds, of course, dire. The good thing about a medically induced coma is that you haven't actually been grievously injured. You're simply put into a coma. And that reflected the economy. You'll see in a moment. The actual economic fundamentals, which, of course, determine how many people fly and when they fly, they ain't bad. They're not bad at all. It's just that we were put in this medically induced coma as a consequence of the pandemic. So I'd ask you to look at the chart there on the bottom left. You know, you look at the history of world air traffic and revenue passenger miles in billions here. And typically in a bad year, you know, like after 9/11, of course, or, you know, Gulf War One or the SARS year, you lose 2 or 3% of traffic. Well, last year, because of that medically induced coma, we lost 66%. We've never seen anything like that in dawn of the jet age. Now, not since World War II, right? And even then, of course, the numbers for world air travel were insignificant. So there is the cause of our problems. Not surprisingly, of course, you get the chart on the right, which shows the world jet fleet, how much of it is unemployed. And, you know, again, in a bad year, typically you go from 10 or 11% parked to 12 or 13% parked. Well, here you can see we peaked out last April and May at about, 60-something percent parked. We all remember. Things have come down. We're at about 30% parked right now. It's getting better. May, I think, was in the high 20s, just came out the other day. So we're kind of recovering slowly as vaccines get administered, as, infection rates go down and hopefully fatality rates continue to go down. And then as borders open up, because that's frankly the biggest remaining barrier to international air transport. Backlogs have held up, except for the 737 MAX. That's a concern, but that hasn't been catastrophic. The important thing to remember about a backlog, and, you know, we have to rediscover this as an industry every, well, sadly, with every shock to the system, that backlogs don't always mean what you think they mean. You know, the old saying, if an airline makes money, it orders planes. If it keeps making money, it takes delivery of those planes. There isn't necessarily a connection. So we have a situation where there are, what, 11,000 jets on backlog, but everyone's deferring delivery. And that's what's been going on the last year. There's been an aftermarket catastrophe that's in some ways worse than the new build drop-off. And that's, of course, because you have a lot of people who destock their warehouses. They're no longer ordering parts, in addition to utilization declining. So it's been very painful for people who were MRO providers, especially, as well as anybody with a profit model that depends upon revenue from spares. That'll recover very fast along with utilization, but it has just been a very difficult 15 months. Next page, please, Ivan. Now, I'm fast becoming known as one of the more optimistic pundits out there. You know, a lot of people think we're going to get back to the air travel peak with the end of this medically induced coma sometime in mid-2023. I am out there taking bets for a drink at the bar, whatever else you want to bet me, that we're going to get back to that 2019 revenue passenger mile peak in late 2022. And that would be, of course, an extraordinary recovery. I genuinely believe it. And when everyone was saying, including me, when everyone was saying a mid-2023 recovery, we didn't know all of the things you see on this page. We had no idea the vaccines would be as good as they are. We had no idea the economy would be as holding up as well, not just in the U.S., but elsewhere. I mean, right now, the Dow is at 34,000. If you'd told me back a year ago that the Dow would be at 34,000 in a year, I would have said you're crazy. Absolutely no way. But here we are. We also, as a consequence of a better than expected economy and people not spending very much money, we have a half century record of savings. So that's what we call dry powder, the ability to travel when travel is allowed. I know my family feels it. I expect many of you do, too. When travel is permissible, we have the money, we have the saved up vacation days, we want to get back out there. So I think it's going to be a fast recovery. And, you know, you look at what China has seen in its domestic travel comeback. It's not always perfect, but it looks pretty great. And the U.S. is starting to see it now. We're almost back domestically. International, again, border closures really complicate things. But all of this leads me to say that we're getting back to where we were in air travel by late 2022. And that drives all of our forecasts, which, as you'll see in a moment, are a pretty steep climb out of the pit we are in. Next page, please. But, of course, nevertheless, this is the situation on the ground now. This is the chart of jetliner deliveries, the most important segment in the aerospace manufacturing biz. And this is just new deliveries. You know, the value add behind it is another couple hundred billion dollars. A lot of the factories in greater Southern California area don't get counted in this because this is just the value of aircraft at the top end. But, of course, it's a proxy for the health of the industry, right? And as you can see, a couple things. One, we've always had cyclicality, just that this cycle was far more weird. You had a double cycle going into it, and it could have kept going for a variety of reasons. But when it came crashing down because of the pandemic, good Lord, look at that. I mean, time to party like it's 2006, right? I mean, that's a heck of a gut punch. Next page, please. Now, why did we have a double cycle? Well, the biggest part of it, in addition to, you know, usual good, strong year-over-year traffic in the 5 to 5.5% growth rate area. It was also because of this dynamic. It's the bifurcation between the cost of capital and the cost of fuel. You look back decades, the two kind of moved in tandem. Now, what did this mean? It means that when you have expensive fuel, airlines want new jets. Obviously, it's a survival mechanism. And they also need third-party finance. The majority of jetliner purchases are financed by third-party capital. So they depend upon, well, that lower number, interest rates. Interest rates determine, well, ultimately, how much you have to pay for your jet at the end of the day, just like buying a house. So what you want and what we got during that double cycle, look at that, the first ever massive spread. It was almost like a Goldilocks environment where airlines had every reason in the world to buy new jets and all the cheap cash with which to do it. So where are we now? Well, if we'd had the conversation a year ago, I'd have told you that COVID-19 was pressuring both indicators downward. It was making cash cheaper and making fuel much cheaper. You probably remember those headlines last year when people were paying you to take the stuff. It was some sort of weird statistical anomaly or something. So there's actually kind of good news on that front, because obviously cheap fuel would be disastrous for this business. You know, you just keep your MD-80s forever and ever. What's the reason to get those out of the fleet? But fuel is coming back. It's we got our nose above $60 a barrel for West Texas, and it's probably going to head higher as world economies kick back into gear. Interest rates are an interesting question, so to speak. And this gets into the tricky question of inflation. You read in any newspaper headline, higher prices, and there's this big debate. Is this just a recovery? Is this supply chain disruptions, particularly in the automobile industry? Or is this something more structural, or simply too much cash has been dumped into the economy? And, you know, ask a dozen people, get 20 ideas. We don't really know. Right now, most investors are not treating this as serious inflation. You know, the price for a 10-year T-bill is 1.4, the interest rate is 1.47. That doesn't imply anyone is thinking inflation. But if we do have inflation, that yellow line at the bottom becomes a problem, because the only remedy for inflation is to jack up interest rates. So we're hoping that inflation stays manageable in the 2% range. 2.5% is where it is now nominally. We're hoping fuel stays above 60, your ideal fuel price for an airline's profitability and for its desire to buy jets is somewhere in that Goldilocks zone, you know, not too hot, not too cold, somewhere around 60 or 70. We appear to possibly be heading into a Goldilocks zone. That's really good. You know, not without risk, inflation, and of course, fuel, you know, that's a volatile indicator. But if we can maintain the kind of spread we see emerging there to the right-hand side of this chart, again, that's a Goldilocks number from the standpoint of new jetliner demand. Next page, please, there, Evan. The other factor that enabled the super cycle, here's where I don't have such good news, I'm afraid. The other factor that promoted this tremendous growth of the past 15 years was China. I mean, back in the 90s, everyone talked about China, but it wasn't showing up in the numbers. Even in 2000, China was only 2% of the world jetliner market. But it was an incredible couple of decades. And by 2018, China was 23%. And I've got the other BRIC countries there for, you know, just for comparison. It's China. Whenever we were talking about raising single aisle production rates over the past decade or so, we were really having a conversation about China's ability to take more of those jets. So here we are, and some bad news. First, on the geopolitical front, obviously, the Chinese are having their difficulties. The Chinese government are having their difficulties with Western governments, particularly the U.S., and the U.S. and other Western countries are having difficulties with them. But also, China seems to be moving away from a market-based economy and towards more of a state-run economy. That's not good. That's not good at all, because there was tremendous commercial energy inside China that everyone was benefiting immensely, including the Chinese. And it seems to be coming down. As a matter of fact, their air travel problems are predating the pandemic. You know, that's a concern. China had been growing at about a 12% clip air travel wise. But that had fallen drastically in 2019. It was only about, by the end of the year, it was only 5.3. So when we talk about a recovery in China, which we've seen, we're really also wondering, is it going to recover to the great days that you see here in this chart? Or is it just going to recover to the not so great days you saw in the year before the pandemic? Obviously, this is a huge area of concern, not least of which for the 737 MAX, because orders for that program, it's about 20-something percent now in China and heading to 30%. And right now, the Chinese government doesn't even seem to be interested in recertifying the type. It's probably a political signal. Maybe they're hoping that it'll be rolled into a broader package of trade negotiations and tariff lifting and whatever else. We'll see, but it's the biggest risk area moving forward. I just showed you a bunch of indicators that I think are tremendously positive. I really believe it. Air traffic, cost of cash, cost of fuel. This is one that I'm afraid I can't say, hey, let's have a party. No, this is a little bit more concerning to me. So it's a watch this space kind of indicator, I'm afraid. Next page, please, Evan. Predictably, orders and deliveries, book-to-bill was no longer a thing last year. We've never seen that before. I would expect this year to see something like, we'll be above zero. Will it be a one-to-one book-to-bill ratio? That is to say, orders matching deliveries? No. The only thing I can tell you is we'll climb out of this. Here's another pit we've got to climb out of. Next page, please. What we're expecting on the basis of all of our assumptions is kind of a weird mix of fortunes. We basically divide the air transport market into three segments. You've got regionals there at the bottom, which have never been a great place. And, that's just an Embraer market at this point, which is good for Embraer. The green line is twin aisles, and the red line is single aisles. And what we're seeing here again is what economists term a K-shaped pattern. K-shapes are turning up all through the economy, whether it's rich versus poor, galloping inequality, internet shopping versus bricks and mortar. K-shaped recoveries are everywhere, and they're in our industry too. This is our the big picture economists talk about this. I'm merely a small picture economist, so I can apply it to our industry, but boy, you sure see it here. Single aisles are going to come roaring back, and you're seeing that with talk of the production rates at Airbus and to a lesser extent Boeing. But a lot of that is a reflection of airline fleet planning that's shifting away from twin aisles and towards single aisles, even for international routes. And you'd seen some of this before the pandemic. As a matter of fact, one of my favorite plane rides ever was from Heathrow to Halifax in a 737. Not everybody loves flying across the Atlantic in a narrow body, but I've got no problem with it. It was point to point, rather than hub to spoke. The economic logic in favor of moving to point, new city pairs, enabled by new longer range single aisle jets like the A320neo, especially the 321neo, and the 737 MAX, really a compelling argument. Excuse me. And you're seeing it show up in the order books. Now, the one thing you should know is that the very steep delta on that single aisle, that red line recovery, part of it, not all of it, but part of it is due to the introduction into service of about 450 MAXs that have already been built but not delivered. As of this month, I think about 50 or 60 have been. They're making progress. But the point is that this steep delta doesn't necessarily reflect strong manufacturing activity. Part of it is just deliveries. But once those MAXes are cleared away, yes, it does. Yes, this chart does reflect really strong activity. Excuse me. Because as we say in the economics world, liquidity preference function. Next page, please. Now, one aspect of this dynamic change away from twin aisles and towards single aisles, it's starting to really heavily favor Airbus, and you can see this in backlog values. Boeing has adjusted their backlog for risk. Airbus has not. So in the interest of fairness to Boeing, we've provided with or without their risk-adjusted backlog. Either way, Airbus is getting ahead a bit. Next page, please. And the reason is simple. This is a breakdown of that backlog, and you can see there's exactly one place that Airbus has an enormous advantage. And that, of course, is 200-seat single aisles. That is the A321neo. Enormously important program. The biggest question we face as an industry, after the recovery, of course, is whether Boeing will rise to this challenge and do the right thing and develop a new aircraft in this class. They had been, of course, developing the new mid-sized airplane. That was probably the wrong idea because it was a twin aisle. And to compete with a single aisle, you need a single aisle. Now, if Boeing does it, they'll do a great job. They always do. But what if they don't do it? I think the consequences for the industry of Airbus, well, having this huge market, you can see how huge it is from this chart, it's enormously consequential. Next page, please. Are they doing it? This is one of the more concerning charts. This is Boeing's engineering spend. How much they spend of their own nickel, not Pentagon money, but their own nickel. And it took a real hit last year to the tune of about 27% down. You can see that on the right. I'm very concerned that they won't do the right thing, and I hope they do. Because, again, Airbus is really gaining market share purely on the basis of this one segment. Next page, please. Our forecast assumes that Boeing doesn't do the right thing. I hope they do, again, and I would urge everyone to beg them to do something. But if they don't, the future looks a lot like this. We've broken down Airbus's numbers. Red is everything else, and the pink is A321neo. It basically gets them to a 60% market share by the end of the decade. And from there, it could easily be 65%, and from there, 70%. You see where I'm going with this. The other thing, of course, is that it comes down to engineering. If Boeing doesn't develop a new jet and they keep firing engineers, at what point do they lose the ability to do what they've always done well, which is create a new aircraft? And it's been since the 787 that they've launched a new clean sheet design. And this is enormously concerning to me, and I think should be for everybody. Next page, please. Here's the, you know, chart of our expectations. And again, because of that fast recovery that we're seeing with single aisles and with air traffic, most importantly, look at the recovery. And again, some of this, just the 400 or so, are jets already built, but still you're talking about really big numbers starting in around 2023, 2024. From an industrial base standpoint, we're going to start seeing long lead item ordering next year for this, and that's really good news. This is the kind of recovery we need. Let's hope everything stays in place in terms of air traffic, in terms of the cost of cash, in terms of the cost of fuel to enable this increase. Next page, please. One thing you should be aware of, however, is that we're a bit of a deflationary industry. You look at the average price paid for a jetliner, 737 and an A320 in this case, it took a real hit last year, according to most accounts. And meanwhile, if you look at the actual production costs that the Federal Reserve says, basically they look at inflationary elements for the aerospace industry in terms of labor, energy, and materials. Those are the three drivers. And they say, we should have been on that blue path. Now, we haven't been. We've been making productivity improvements and squeezing suppliers and whatever else to keep that rather deflationary lower lines, those deflationary lower lines going. I'm a little concerned if we do have inflation, this industry is going to get hit. Now, contracts often include pass-throughs so that the cost of inflation is taken care of, but sometimes they don't in the commercial world, not the military world, but in the commercial world. So if you're a commercial supplier, watch your contracts because, again, inflation is a departure scenario, but it's something you got to worry about from a risk management standpoint. Next page, please. Regional aircraft, like I said, not much going on there. Increasingly, it's an Embraer E2 market plus ATR. the two big casualties of last year, one with the Mitsubishi regional jet, it might come back, but it might not. They shelved it. They said, we'll reconsider. And the other is Bombardier, which gave up the Ghost and regional aircraft altogether. So it's now Embraer's market. Next page, please. Business aircraft, you know, not surprisingly, it took a hit last year, but that's coming back pretty fast. Next page, please. We've seen a bit of a bifurcation again between basically bottom half jets and top half jets. There's another K, yet another K-shaped pattern in the economy in these markets. And big cabin stuff there at the top, you know, your Gulfstreams, your Dassaults, your Bombardier Global Series, has behaved very differently over the past decade compared to the smaller stuff, your Cessnas, your Embraers, your Learjets, your Hawker Beechcrafts back a dozen years ago. And that's the blue line. Now, what we have with the blue line forecast and the maroon line forecast is what we were expecting last year. The red line and the green line are what we're getting. So bit of an adjustment from COVID-19, but again, we're seeing a reasonably fast recovery. Next page, please. Turning now to the defense side, you know, one key distinction between this downturn and the terrible 2002 downturn is that, good news, investment accounts at DOD are much higher. And this is actually true globally. Defense spending is much higher globally than it was back in 2002. Matter of fact, the procurement budget, the budget that buys weapons, that's that blue line there in the middle, that's it's more than twice as big as it was during the last downturn. So that's important from the standpoint of, the health of the industrial base. And the good news is that last year, the government recognized this and accelerated payments to many contractors who were feeling the effects of the commercial downturn. So I think this accelerated payment program, along with the Paycheck Protection Program, is actually going to be remembered by historians of economics as two government programs that really did an awful lot of good in getting the industry through this downturn. Actually, kind of an impressive achievement. I remember talking about it and watching it all done in real time back, last spring. And it's almost miraculous how quickly things were implemented and how much good it did. Next page, please. Now, I get asked a question a lot by investors and company executives. Is all of the heavy spending on the economy, the infrastructure package, whatever else, is it going to impact, and of course, COVID-19 in general, is it going to impact defense spending? You look back at the history of defense spending, going back to 1948, there's absolutely no correlation between economics and defense. Defense is driven by threat and perception of threat in politics. And right now, with the rise of China, the perceived fear of China, and close to a gridlock in Congress and the Senate, that's a recipe for pretty strong defense spending. It would take a far worse economic outlook to pressure defense downward. And sure enough, the defense budget, the first Biden defense budget is up 1.7% relative to the very high Trump budget. So things are looking great on the defense side. Next page, please. The market for combat aircraft in the U.S., tactical aircraft procurement. The good news is we're still at that Reagan peak. You know, you look at spending on tactical combat aircraft, it's in adjusted dollars about the same as it was in the great years of the Reagan buildup. Problem is, because of the increasing cost and complexity of combat aircraft, we're buying fewer planes. You can see that red line there corresponding to the left side. Units procured, the Reagan peak was 387 fighters. The current peak, I guess you could call it the Trump and now Biden peak, it's the same budget basically, it's about 100 fighters. So we're having to spend a lot more on legacy fleet sustainment. There may or may not be legacy fleet cuts as a consequence. But all this to say, it's a secure market because, frankly, there just aren't enough combat planes to do the job. Next page, please. Here's our chart of the U.S. military aircraft industry the past, 27 years or so. And the next 10. A couple things to notice. First of all, of course, you've got the F-35 playing a larger and larger role in industrial output. The only new stuff is there at the top, with the T-7 trainer from St. Louis Boeing and the B-21 there in California. I would point out the B-21 is California's only aircraft, only fixed-wing aircraft, with apologies to Robinson there and Torrance. So it's good to see California back in the finished aircraft product game. It's an enormously important program. We're expecting at least 100 to be built to the tune of about $500 million each. The other stuff isn't going away. C-130s, FA-18s, F-15s, F-16s, still going, it's going to fade towards the end of the decade, but in the here and now, still doing a lot of good work there. Next page, please. Picture's a little different in Europe. But very simply, they don't have the F-35. They don't have the B-21. Now, the existing programs, Eurofighter, Rafael, Gripen, they're hanging in there. Some, like A-400M, are trending downward. The biggest question Europe faces is, well, can they get their act together for a new generation of planes? And of course, when you read headlines about the Franco-German SCAF program or the British Tempest program, it's all about this question. The problem is that no matter what they do, no matter how it happens, they won't be cutting metal until the mid-2030s. So even if Europe is gaining market share in commercial, they're losing a bit of market share on the military side. Next page, please. The rotorcraft market, here we divide it into three buckets, 10 years of history, 10 years of forecast. And civil is took a hit, of course, coming back. International military solid. U.S. programs of record are trending downward, and this is another very big question we face. Will the Pentagon get the Future Vertical Lift program going in time to rescue a rather difficult picture, or will they simply have to reinvent current platforms like the Chinook, the Apache, Blackhawk, and whatever else, because FVL proves too unaffordable or maybe just overpromised technologically? We don't know the answer. Either way, it won't be decided till after our forecast period. Next page, please. Here's what we're expecting this year and next, and the heat lamp there in the middle is risk, of course. You're seeing a return to black this year, which is welcome news. Problem is, a lot of it's a bit of an illusion. You look at that 51% jump in single-aisle jets, a lot of those planes have been built. They've been in storage. Those are the 400-and-something aircraft, the max aircraft that Boeing had built but not delivered. That's true for some of 2022 as well. So the next couple of years, we're seeing deliveries and markets that look pretty good, but it might not be the same robust, healthy increase for everybody. It might just be a bit of a, frankly, a statistical fluke as deliveries get recorded, but much less manufacturing activity gets performed. On the positive side, there are some markets like fighters, 29% growth, a lot of stuff that was going to be built last year, but got delayed, so we're looking at a strong snapback there. Bottom line there, as you can see on the right, is we're getting back to where we were, the peak, basically the 2019 peak, in 2024 across all segments. Next page, please. One thing I'm always keen to remind people about is that this is, I think, a far more top-heavy market than people realize. I follow about 130 programs out there, me and my colleagues. And I love all of them. I'd be building model kits of them if I wasn't being an economist for them. But really, 5 or 20, depending upon your perspective, are the real needle movers. And here in the blue, you've got the next 10 years of revenue. And the orange, you've got the last 10 years of revenue. And the top 5 programs are more than half of output. And the next 15 or another 21%. So 77% of this industry is these 20 programs. And by the way, the Airbus A320, that's kind of throwing shade on everybody else. It's just enormously important. 4 different production lines, Hamburg, Tianjin, Mobile, and of course, Toulouse. Another thing is that barriers to entry, extremely high. All of these companies have been around since World War I, basically, except for Embraer, which joined in 1969. It's tough to break into this market, tough to break into this industry. Next page, please. Now, the U.S.'s share, not surprisingly, took a real hit last year, not because we're not good at building aircraft, but because of the MAX. The MAX shutdown really knocked U.S. output, both in absolute terms and in relative terms, down. One key, that'll recover, of course, along with the MAX and along with the F-35 and the B-21. I wouldn't worry about this number. We'll be back above that 50% mark for world output. I would argue in the long run, this number will be helped enormously if Boeing does the right thing and launches a new jet. Again, that's my highest priority. Next page, please. One sort of big soup of words, since we're running low on time, I'll let you read it at your leisure. But one point I make is that whether you look at society or whether you look at our beloved industry, you know, it's the same story. Very little is new. It's an acceleration, a magnification of pre-existing trends, whether it's the death of movie theaters and the rise of e-commerce or the increasing predominance of point-to-point flights and a greater reliance on single-aisle jets, you know, and so many of these other factors. They were trends. China, the China question, all of these were pre-existing issues. Again, I'll let you read through it, but basically the way to look at COVID-19 and its impact on this industry, it's everything that was coming at us. It's only coming at us a lot faster than we expected. And we're dealing with the consequences of that now. Next page, please. Here it is, the macro chart that shows civil and military output in this business. Military looking good. There's that blue line. The red line at there at the top, that's what I'd been saying last January. The green line, what we got. And again, the only thing I can say by way of consolation is that, boy, it sure feels better to be crawling out of a pit, seeing the light up there, than it does to be falling into this pit. And last year, we were falling into that pit. I hope that from the standpoint of industry morale and, of course, order activity and employment and everything like that, we begin to see a much bigger attitude, a more optimistic viewpoint this year. And I think you're starting to see it already. So, again, we're not where we would have been if this hadn't happened, but we are on our way back, and I feel good about that. And I think, given the time, it's best to turn back over to Gerardo here. Thank you so much for listening to me. One last chart. This just shows relative recovery rates. Thanks for keeping me honest there, Ivan. But the only market I'm worried about, bottom line, is twin-aisle jets. That's a real laggard here in terms of getting back to the peak. Everything else gets back to the peak in 23 or 24. It's only twin-aisle jets that you have to watch out for. And with that, I'm definitely turning over back to Gerardo. Again, thank you for listening.
Thank you, Richard, very much. It was an incredible presentation. I just want to do a bit of time check. Ivan, do we still have time for a couple questions? If you have any questions, please put them on the chat. I do have a couple questions about the general state of the market. In particular about the aftermarket for commercial aircraft, which you mentioned at the beginning. And what do you think is the outlook for all of these companies that supply the whole supply chain of components, especially now that we have these big fleets are parked in the middle of the desert here in California, and probably a good source of at least some parts. What does it mean for all these other companies that manufacture for these, for the big builders?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. You're going to see in many ways an even faster recovery in the aftermarket than you are in new build. And the reason for that is pretty simple. First of all, dealing with the parked fleets, they're going to come back fast. You know, you're going to be, we're down to 28%. You're going to see that fall to 10 or 11 by the end of next year. Pretty confident in that. And the other aspect is that the massive destocking that you saw during the downturn as airlines tried to conserve cash and didn't order any new components, that's going to reverse itself. And remember, airlines didn't just destock their warehouses. they did every other cash-saving maneuver they could. That meant deferring maintenance. That meant rotating green time engines and APUs between aircraft to avoid having to do a red line, you know, to deal with red line, which means that sometime next year, probably, the warehouses will be empty, aircraft will be flying again, and not only that, all those systems will all be at red time and needing to be overhauled. And, oh, on top of that, the deferred maintenance will come due. So I think you're going to have a fantastic recovery. And this is probably the place where paycheck protection programs did the most good, because, frankly, we'd be in a world of hurt if we had to go through this terrible downturn in the MRO biz and not have the workers in place. And even now, I really think, you know, it's going to, frankly, be one of the bigger bottlenecks, finding the skilled labor to make this happen. I guess there are worse problems to have, but it's going to be a challenge.
Okay, very, very, very good. There are a couple of questions kind of on a slightly different topic. I was going to ask about your opinion about this new deal between United and Boom Supersonic, this an entirely new category of aircraft. And someone's also asking in the chat about the sky taxis and the Uber of the skies and all these electric airplanes. What do you think the outlook is for this kind of new, potentially new category of aircraft going to, mostly for civilian aviation?
Yeah, mostly civilian, that's right. I want to believe an awful lot of it seems to be Silicon Valley money, which is not aerospace money. And a lot of the maneuvers, the financial maneuvers to make these things happen seem a bit opaque to me. I mean, I never had to figure out what a special purpose acquisition company was before. Supersonics, I'm always going to be intrigued by. I think anybody who loves this industry is intrigued by supersonics. The big problem with supersonics has always been that, A, Asia is off limits. You just can't do Asia unless you stop in Hawaii, which defeats the purpose. And also, finding enough routes with enough full fare, basically first-class passengers on them. And you could put a dozen of these planes into service overnight on New York to London and Paris. How many other routes are there that have that number of high rollers on them? I don't know. It seems like there are big challenges there. So, you know, it looks like it's a way of possibly, you know, if they get to a certain point with Boom, I have no doubt that Airbus and Boeing will simply say, all right, we're buying you. We'll make that happen. But if they don't, it'll simply be just a lot of investor cash just dumped into something that doesn't go anywhere. And we saw this with Aireon, which died a couple weeks ago. After 18 years, I still regarded Aireon as a pretty good idea with a lot of caveats. But I would have thought that somebody could have made it work, and it didn't. So I'm a little concerned that, I guess the bottom line is, I'm a little concerned that a lot of these ideas are going to leave investors high and dry. Might not be pretty.
Yes, it's intriguing. It's always, I guess, always fun to see new aircraft and new ideas kind of roll off the production line. But then it's getting paying customers. That's the challenge. I think we have time for another question. Maybe. And my power is going down, so I'm going to try to next a second. So another question that we have is how do you think the pandemic affects differently different commercial airlines for different routes, because different parts of the world are opening at different speeds. So what the effect you think will be that on the
Yeah, you know, that's a great question. And basically speaking, there were, I guess you could say, four different groups, and only one of them is a major cause for concern. You know, if you're a legacy carrier, you know, flag carrier, effectively, we don't call them that here in the U.S., but you get the idea. you're fine because people want to give you money. And frankly, government's provided you with a great deal of support. You know, I mean, you look at the American Big Four, including Southwest, they're fine. There's no worries. And they recover nicely with domestic traffic. International flag, that's a little trickier, but, you know, the likes of Lufthansa and Air France, KLM, have also gotten a lot of government support. They'll be fine. Low-cost carriers, I think they smell an opportunity. As a matter of fact, it's kind of weird. You've got new ones coming like Avaleo and Breeze because, you know, frankly, they know how to function in a very low-cost, low-fare environment, and they see an opportunity here. I think they'll be fine. So far, they've come through pretty nicely. On balance. Then you got the super connectors. This is I guess you could call this also an area of concern. So we're talking Emirates, Etihad, Qatar. They have a lot of money behind them, but they were heavily dependent upon India traffic and on international traffic in general. 90% of their traffic was international, 100% really international. So they're cushioned by local investors, you know, especially Qatar, but their exposure to world aviation industry, ooh, it's been grim. It's been really grim. And then finally, the most vulnerable is what you might call stateless, international, typically low cost. And there you've seen the most damage. So AirAsia X, Norwegian, anybody with an idea to sort of globalize the industry without a, you know, a home, they've been hit most by the fall in international traffic. And, of course, the lack of a supporting government in many cases. So that's where you're seeing kind of the most damage. The good news is the overwhelming bulk of the order book is held by the other three kinds. The only thing I would watch for is that third kind, those Middle Eastern super connectors, they're about half the market for the 777X. So when you read headlines about delays and problems with 777X, a lot of it revolves around that one segment of the airline industry that's been hit quite a lot by this pandemic.
Okay, sorry, Richard, I'm back. Sorry, I had a battery problem with my computer, but we're back. What did I miss, I guess?
I just answered the airline question. You're exactly at the right time to ask another question. It's perfect.
Okay, perfect. Sorry about the noise. There's a question here about there's also the Bombas prospects. Do you know anything about that?
Is it a new program?
Just trying to get back the chat on my screen.
I don't know. That was my question. I don't know if you can hear me. I was asking, what's your opinion of Bombardier's prospects now? Everything but the BJs and Dassault has now entered the large cabin love triangle with the 10X.
Yeah, no, thank you for asking that. And that's Bombardier. Okay, yeah, should have figured that out. It's the world's only pure play, publicly traded business jet prime. That's not an impossible place to be, right? I mean, it's a good business. They've got a great product line, great legacy. They're really, however, a hostage to the market. In other words, we get hit by a serious downturn, maybe next year, probably not, but who knows? And they get hit too. And then it's just a question of them servicing their debt load, which is pretty substantial. And the biggest factor is that their two biggest competitors have robust military size, General Dynamics and Dassault, and they're willing to do whatever it takes to power through, which explains the Falcon 10X. It's basically paid for by Dassault's strong military revenue. So they can get through this, they can do this, but they're vulnerable, pure and simple. As for the 10X, looks like a really nice jet. They're a little late to the game, you know, I mean, it's been a long time since Dassault played at the very top of the market. But it looks again like a pretty good jet and a clear indicator that they're willing to take their substantial military revenue and plow it into new development on the civil side of the house. So if I were Bombardier, I'd be wary. And obviously the best way to hedge your position is to start thinking about who you'd like to sell to maybe one day. And is that inevitable? No. Is it more than possible? Somewhere between possible and inevitable, I guess you could put it like that.
Yeah, totally agree. Thank you.
Okay, I think we are at the end of our presentation of the Q&A. Richard, thank you very much. This has been a fantastic presentation. I guess I'm just going to begin to wrap things up. So, Ivan, if we can go to the next slide. So, just a little reminder, again, thank you, Richard, very much.
Thank you.
Next upcoming events, July 15, we're going to kind of a bit of a continuation of something we talked about today, the future of the wide body jet, with Jens Fortol, that's how you spell, that's how you pronounce it. On August 26th, we're going to have, courtesy of the Ventura chapter, Leon Alkali, as a fellow from JPL, we're going to talk about a topic to be discussed, but something to look forward to in August. And in September, a business health assessment, whether exiting or not, which may or may not be relevant to several people in the industry. Next slide. Just a reminder again of the Aerospace and Defense Forum. There is an individual membership and a corporate membership, which gives you access to the recordings and to the presentations. Note that the meeting notices are sent only to those on the AAD Forum mailing list, so please sign up for the newsletter. That part is free. Remember, you can become a member for, as I said, $350 per year, but it provides you with access to all the webinars and also to the recordings. And there's also sponsorship opportunities, which allows you to have a few minutes at the beginning of every presentation to kind of present something about your company and a subject matter that's of interest to the community. And I think with that, we have come to the end of this presentation. Thank you very much, everyone, for attending. And again, Richard, thank you very much. It's been a great presentation. And we look forward to seeing you all in the future.